This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. Our guest today is Joe Mann. W. Joseph Mann is director of the Rural Church Division of the Duke Endowment and associate professor at Duke Divinity School. Welcome, Joe. Can you hear me?
I can, Steve. Hi.
We're talking with Joe Mann in Charlotte, North Carolina, by telephone, and we'll be letting listeners talk with him and ask questions later in the program. Let me give you the numbers if people would like to call. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free number. In Champaign-Urbana, you may access several local lines by punching in 333-9455. Well, we're going to be talking about a specialty that you have developed over the years, and that is the small congregation. How did you first get interested in this?
Well, in some ways, that's where I came from. I grew up in a small town in North Carolina. Actually, it no longer even exists, not on the map. Jonesboro was a part of a small membership church, which was actually a charge in the Methodist lingo. We were on a circuit of two churches, Jonesboro and Lemon Springs. But my real interest came, I guess, twofold. When I was directing continuing education at Duke Divinity School, many of the pastors that I saw were coming from small membership churches. North Carolina has a lot of small membership churches, as does all of Protestantism. So we saw at Duke many pastors and lay people from small membership churches. And then about almost 15 years ago now, I went to the Duke Endowment, and we have a special mission. A portion of our endowment is earmarked by Mr. Duke and his indenture to serve specifically rural United Methodist churches. So I guess both at the Divinity School and now at the Endowment, I've come to have an appreciation for, and now, of course, a duty to serve these churches. So I guess that's where it came from. I kind of lived it for a while, moved away from it. My first parish was a fairly urban parish, and then a campus minister at NC State with you just a few years ago, and moved to smaller membership churches and worked with them in the last 20-some years.
Now, you mentioned being at the Duke Endowment 15 years, this is a pool of money that's available in this case to help small churches, rural churches, is that correct?
That's right. The Duke Endowment was established in 1924 by James Buchanan Duke, and I'll take just a second with this. We do really four things. We helped establish and continue to be important partners with Duke University. We also, by indenture, are able to assist Davidson College, a small Presbyterian school just outside of Charlotte, Furman University, a school in Greenville, South Carolina, and Johnson C. Smith, a historically black school that's here in Charlotte. Secondly, Mr. Duke realized that, particularly in the rural South in 1924, health care would be an enormous need, and so we have funded since 1924 not-for-profit hospitals in North and South Carolina. And ironically, that need has only risen in the last while with health needs and cost escalating. Thirdly, we fund what were orphanages, ways to care for orphans. Mr. Duke felt like some of the neediest people in our society would be orphans, and we continue that work. But that's expanded quite a bit as the definition of orphans has changed. So we offer a bit broader look at how we support children and families in crisis. And then the fourth division is the Rural Church Division that I head. Mr. Duke was baptized by a circuit-riding Baptist preacher. Washington Duke, the father, was baptized probably before the Civil War, and at that point had a love for the church and love for small membership churches that just continued. And so when the Duke Endowment was established, we have the rather unusual task of serving a very specific rural United Methodist churches. We have an endowment of about $2.3 billion and make grants of slightly over $100 million in the Carolinas in this year. And our division will make grants of about $11 million to beneficiary rural churches and Duke Divinity School.
Now, our listeners that are primarily here in the Middle West, in Illinois and Indiana, may be curious as to why I asked that leading question about the money of Duke Endowment, since it is limited to the state of North Carolina and indeed limited in this case to Methodist churches. But it strikes me that James B. Duke, in leaving this this huge amount of money for these purposes, maybe an example for current people with deep pockets who maybe haven't had an example before them recently of someone who could do this kind of thing.
Well, that's I couldn't agree more. What Mr. Duke decided to do with his wealth was he realized he could do any number of things, but decided to focus on the areas where, one, his family grew up and basically where his wealth was created in the Carolinas. And so focused on a geographic area, and I think that has actually been a help to us. We've been able to probably be more effective by working in a smaller area than perhaps had he set the whole nation or the whole world. That's one. But your point's well raised. Steve, as you probably know, there are not many foundations that actually support religious organizations or religious programs.
I have noticed that.
Yeah. They tend to be frightened, I think. If you ever start with one, where will you ever end?
Sure.
And
sure.
I guess the demands would be great. So I'm not unsympathetic, but at the other side, if you set some parameters, if you set some goals for what you'd like your own endowment to do or your own foundation to do, it can be an enormous asset, and particularly to community churches who are integral to the life of many communities, and just a little help along the way can enliven them and to assist them in their outreach and to their ministry in communities, ministries that are often just really crucial for the life of citizens and communities.
Well, I want to get into, of course, finding out what you've been able to do with these kind of resources to be helpful to small congregations in your area. But before we do that, you mentioned that small churches are everywhere. Small congregations are everywhere. You mentioned Protestantism, but it's also, I guess, true, becoming more true in Catholic parishes as well. But tell us about Protestantism. Where do people go to church?
Well, they mostly go to small membership churches. In terms of just the vast number of churches. In American Protestantism, roughly 54% of all Protestant churches will have fewer than 100 people on a Sunday. And as a matter of fact, some numbers will actually slice that even a little bit smaller, 70 to 50 people on a Sunday. So the irony is there, as you said, that mostly Protestantism is made up of small membership churches, and as you said, just all over the place. North Carolina is a good example of that. Just of Methodist churches alone, there are fully 1,300 beneficiary churches that are small membership rural churches that I can assist in North Carolina alone. Catholicism, as you indicated, certainly has a growing number of small membership churches too, but it's tended to be, early at least in its life, a more of an urban phenomenon, and many Catholic parishes are quite large. Protestantism has also changed a great deal, so that in fact on any given Sunday, more Protestants are actually involved in the life of a church in a larger urban church, but there are far more smaller membership churches in the countryside, if that makes sense. That I'm not sure that was clear or not.
I think I understand. You're saying that in terms of the total number of people in worship on a Sunday morning, most of them will be in large churches.
Yes.
But in terms of the number of churches, there are a lot more small churches
than
big ones.
Just a lot more. And that leads to the need for denominations and associations of churches to have pastors to serve these many churches. I guess a small example, I preached today at a small membership church in the northern part of the state, northeastern part of the state, and we had a big crowd there, actually. With me coming to preach, you would imagine a big crowd. I think there were about 230 people there. So that was, for that congregation, quite a large congregation. on many Sundays they would be closer to 100, 150 is what the minister said. Whereas when I'm not preaching at a small membership church, I typically worship at an urban church here in Charlotte. 4,000 members, we were, are worshiping now about 2,000 people on a Sunday. So one church in Charlotte can take care of, what, 20 in terms of membership, small membership churches. It's a particular problem for denominations who try to think about giving patterns, and there's no question that the larger, more urban church has a lot of sway. That becomes the model because that's the model that will pay the bills, that will, with tithes and offerings, will contribute to the larger church in ways that small membership churches have trouble. For some denominations, a small membership church seems to be a drain in terms of cost of personnel, et cetera. So yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon that we often look at the mega church and the growth of our urban churches, but in fact, we have far more Protestant small membership churches.
Now, in terms of these churches in rural areas and small towns, just like small towns themselves, there's been predictions for decades that they're going to just die off. They're just going to disappear. And yet small churches, as well as small towns, are hanging on, and some of them are even growing, and some people are choosing to leave the urban areas to go back to those small towns for various reasons. What have you noticed about how small churches have this tenacity?
Well, tenacity is just the right word. There's a remarkable staying power to these churches. They represent a sense of place, a sense of history, a sense of belonging that particularly in a transient society when people are moving around quite a bit, and in a society where I think people are often lacking in some basic human communities, these churches provide for people a sense of place, a sense of belonging. And you're absolutely right. Today I saw a couple at the little church I preached at who said they had driven almost 2 hours and do that every Sunday to come back home to this small membership church. Yeah, the predictions that they would disappear have proven false. In some cases, they won't prove false, of course. The churches do reach a point where they, without migration, with small membership and with one-generation membership, and we have several of those churches, certainly in North Carolina and across the country, where they've aged out. They boomed perhaps in the 50s and early 60s, but most of their children have moved out. They've been educated. They want to get good-paying jobs. They don't want to stay on the farm. They don't want to stay in the local community, and so they move out. And the small membership church can sometimes be threatened, obviously, by that out-migration of population. No one really to turn to for new blood and for new membership. And then the demands for keeping the building up and paying the minister and doing all the things that churches have to do become quite large on a small number of folk. But those small number of people and congregants have just a remarkable faithfulness, again, to these churches. You commented, we do see in North Carolina, I think we see it across the country, several places where people to move out of cities or where cities have themselves sprawled out some into countrysides, some of these small membership churches suddenly find themselves in the midst of some growth. What had been farms in North Carolina are now becoming often upscale housing developments for people in the Research Triangle of Raleigh and Durham and Chapel Hill, and the same with Charlotte and Greensboro and Winston-Salem, and I suspect some similar things for you in the Midwest and in large urban areas. So suddenly, some small membership churches see growth that they never expected and are not always prepared to deal with either. So yes, they have a tenacity to stay in place, and a challenge for them is once they're in place, or since they are in place, often to respond to growth and opportunity, and that is a real challenge for these churches.
I want to ask about what some of the programs are that you encourage and some of the outreach efforts, your money enables some of these congregations to do, the money from the Duke Endowment. But let me take just a moment to reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Joe Mann. W. Joseph Mann is director of the Rural Church Division of the Duke Endowment that has a bit over $2 billion in the endowment to be helpful to small churches in North Carolina, small Methodist churches. And he's also an adjunct professor at Duke Divinity School, and I want to talk a little bit about how pastors are prepared to serve in some of these churches as well. But let me give the phone numbers again so that listeners in our area or people who are listening online at WILL.UIUC.EDU may want to talk to our guest. There's a toll-free number that can be used anywhere in the continental U.S., 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course, here at the University of Illinois. In Champaign-Urbana, several lines can be reached by punching in 333-9455. Well, let's do talk a bit about these the programs that churches can do. They have a limited number of people.
Right.
They may be in a small town or rural area.
Right.
What are the needs?
Well, often, I'll just start in with one great need. Often, a small membership, and for me, typically rural church, they need youth. They need children. They need some more people coming to the church so that the church can go beyond the generation that's there. But they don't have children themselves. Their children have gone, and perhaps in some areas there hasn't been a remarkable growth. So what are they to do? Or if growth is beginning, how do they attract them? A program that we have found to be both an important ministry as well as a way to, I guess, frankly, evangelize or at least to try to entice persons in the church are child care programs. We have been assisting with child care for, well, it was a bit before I got there, but we really have emphasized it over the last 15 years. There is an enormous need throughout the country, whether, frankly, in rural areas or urban, for affordable, accessible, and quality child care. Often, our church buildings are not as utilized during the week as some of us would like, or maybe put more positively, at least there are facilities there that could be adapted for child care use, either part day or full day child care. We have found that many congregations are willing to say, yes, we have in some ways a theological sense of care for children, our baptismal rites to care for all children, but also just a sense of mission, a sense of that their parents and families need some help so that they can care for their children in a good way. And so, and by the way, I think families often really do look at church-based child care with appreciation, that they feel trust that the church can and often does provide a quality of care that you don't always find in a for-profit or standalone. So for about 15 years now, we have been providing a wide range of assistance. Maybe the first assistance we provide is often some technical assistance. We have funded persons who have a lot of background in child care to go out and to talk to rural churches to tell them what they would need to mount such a program. In most states, after-school programs or preschool programs or part-day programs are not terribly complicated. You don't have to have enormous staff. You don't have to change, adapt your building very much. There are some things you'll have to do, but not as much as for full day care. And we often then make grants after this consultation when I go out to visit and we send a technical assistant. Then we'll make a grant for a church to start an after-school program, say.
Let me interrupt just there at this point, if I could. We have a caller waiting on our toll-free line, and I never know if they may be on a cell phone, so they may be in a hurry. Let's go to line four. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Joe Mann.
Yes. This is what you're talking about, like the more conventional older churches, you know, like in the small area. Have you noticed that the people are just gravitating to the bigger churches, or is there Christianity dwindling out in America?
Well, I think if I heard your question right, we all do in terms of, I think every religion battles against secularism, battles against the fact that so many of our citizens aren't going anywhere to any religious group. On the other side, I think there are some remarkable statistics that indicate that Americans still have a desire for faith, or want to reach out to something that goes beyond themselves and sense of meaning and purpose. And so, in fact, in certain areas, I know in the Southeast, where we've had a lot of migration from other parts of the state into the Southeast, and I'm sure in some other parts of the country that I don't know as well, we have seen growth, actually, in many churches. So I guess your question, in some areas it's certainly waning and declining. In some other areas, we are seeing growth and a certain amount of robustness. I think I missed part of your question, though. I think I left out something.
I think the caller was partly wondering whether Christianity was dying away in this country, and it was interesting. I heard just this week a lecture by a historian who was here at the University of Illinois campus visiting from Notre Dame, and he was saying that it's remarkable that still something like, I think he said 70% of Americans, when asked about basic Christian beliefs, affirm them.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say. I wanted to say that there is still a strength to organized religion. There's no question that there is still an ongoing battle for churches and religious groups in a culture that will that will often abandon the organized church. At the same time, there is such a hunger for connectedness, a hunger for a sense of purpose and meaning that many of our churches are, in fact, as you just were getting at, as you're the historian, get it, people believe and people want to act on that belief. So that some of our smaller membership churches with older membership sometimes have trouble reaching out and being attractive to those folks, that's always a challenge. But in fact, the fields are ripe, as the scriptures say, and there's still plenty of room for churches to grow and to be responsive to needs in the community.
Since I'm talking to someone who teaches at Duke Divinity School, I should say who the historian was I was quoting. It was George Marsden, who did teach at Duke before he went to Notre Dame.
So. Indeed, George is a friend and a wonderful historian, and we miss him. We're glad he's at Notre Dame, but we miss him at Duke.
We have another caller waiting on one of our local lines. Let's go to line one. You're on the Keeping the Faith with our guest, Joe Mann.
Hi. I just have a comment and a question. My comment is that I think there are all kinds of accessible and affordable housing of children, but the question is, can you use the people that are afflicted that have diagnosis of chronic diseases, Alzheimer's, for example? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer off the air. Thank you.
So the caller is asking how churches, particularly small churches, might be able to respond to people with other sorts of needs, like chronic health problems such as Alzheimer's.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I was just a few moments ago talking about, as you asked, one of our early outreach programs has been to children, but for child care. But indeed, many of our, almost all of our churches are like the population itself, aging. We are seeing more and more congregants who are getting older, which is, of course, a good alternative to get older. So that we have found churches both within the life of the congregation and then outreach to the broader community can indeed offer programs for aging populations. And one of the greatest needs is what we refer to as respite care. Many families are trying to care for someone with either a chronic illness or some dementia or some issue with regard to aging. That means it's almost impossible, or is impossible, for them to really leave this person for any amount of time. We have found that churches can offer the occasional program, or in some instances the daily program, just as we have programs for child care. We also have helped assist churches who will offer elder care programs, for instance. Those have been very successful in many of our communities, ways that churches quite naturally do the things they do best, care for one another, offer programs, offer a way to come for a meal, offer some fellowship, offer some time that the person who is in need can get some assistance, but maybe even more important, for at least a couple or 3 hours a day or a few hours a week, the caretaker, who often is overburdened, can get some free time, can bring their loved one to the church for the program, and then they can go and do some shopping or take care of some business they need to take care of, or actually, in many instances, also have a program for themselves, something that will talk about what the issues are of having to deal with an aging parent or someone with a dementia. We also have seen, particularly in some remote areas, the need for just straight-out clinic and medical clinic and medical assistance type of programs. We have some churches that offer, and again, we've assisted them in this, doctors who come in and provide at least a clinic for a basic needs. Perhaps the most popular program and an available program, I think, is a parish nurse program. These are programs that we first saw in urban churches, where an urban church would hire a nurse who would serve the parish and serve the parish by making house calls, checking on often elderly congregants, but others who had health needs too,
and a lot of health education.
Thank you. They were holding health fairs and working with the youth group and just throughout the church, offering education as well as direct services. Those are harder to do in rural settings because, as we were saying earlier, these rural churches often don't have the kind of budget, the kind of congregation that could support a nurse. So what we have done is actually helped fund what could be referred to as regional parish nurses who would organize, often lay nurses. Many of our rural churches will have, a lay nurse, I didn't say that right. What I meant to say was someone who would not be paid, a volunteer, but who's a nurse. Mm-hmm. And with a little bit of help, a little bit of thought about what it means to be a parish nurse, some training, then they can work in their congregation and some other congregations to offer some of those same services. The parish nurse, as you said, can do education, can come in and help check on whether a congregant is taking their medicine, taking their medications, a check on very simple blood tests and pulse and heart and all that kind of thing, as well as just a kind of friendly how are you outreach. So in an ironic way, the church was the first hospital in medieval times, and in some ways that's kind of coming back around, where the church, even in small membership settings, is still a hospice, a place of caring for people with sometimes rather severe needs. We have a program that we're funding all over, actually North Carolina, that sponsors care teams. Congregations can often help surround a person who is at home with a debilitating disease or even perhaps near death.
And so this might take the place of what in an urban area would be a hospice.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And again, in small areas, hospices often are not terribly available for some of the reasons we've already said. So if we can help a church congregation team become aware of just some very basic caring techniques and what it means to surround a person with love and concern, then we can make interventions that become very important, too, because they allow the congregant to stay in the community, to stay often even at home, not be institutionalized. And that's very important for, I think, almost all of us, and certainly important for people who have this strong attachment to place and to church and community. So those are some of the things that we've tried to do and are still trying to do to to help congregations both learn their role and then to act on their role of being support agents in the community.
We're about halfway through our time today on Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for the programs, and our guest today is W. Joseph Mann, who is director of the Rural Church Division of the Duke Endowment, where James B. Duke left about, at this point, it's worth about $2.3 billion, I think he said. Joe said that the interest from which can be used to be helpful to small congregations in the Methodist Church in North Carolina. He's also an adjunct professor at Duke Divinity School. I'm going to let Joe take a sip of water for a second while I make a few announcements for local listeners. Coming up here on Keeping the Faith next week, we'll be talking with Kevin Kelly, who's the director of the Prairie Ensemble, about the upcoming performance of The Creation by Franz Joseph Haydn. The performance will be with the Bach Chorus and the Prairie Ensemble. At 7 o'clock, there'll be a concert conversation about the upcoming program. The concert itself will start at 7:30 at Wesley United Methodist Church and Wesley Foundation here at the University of Illinois campus. That's coming up Friday, May 6, 7:30. Tickets are available at $10, $8 for seniors, $5 for students, coming up at Wesley United Methodist Church, Wesley Foundation. That's at the corner of Green and Goodwin in Urbana, 1203 West Green. Kevin will be on the air with us April 24, next Sunday, talking about that upcoming concert. On May 1st, our guest will be an artist, Rose Marshak, whose current art project is called Tickets to the Sunset. She's been selling tickets for people to see a sunset on a particular day. It's a very interesting project. We'll be talking with the artist Rose Marshak on May 1st here on Keeping the Faith. And then on May 8th, Sarah Hyatt, representing the Christian Science Church, will be our guest talking about issues in Christian Science. Coming up later this week on WILL, How Men Pray, poems by Philip Deaver, professor of English at Rollins College. That'll be Tuesday at 1 o'clock. April is National Poetry Month, and Celeste Quinn will be talking with Philip Deaver a little bit after 1 o'clock on Tuesday on Afternoon Magazine here on WILL. And similarly, David Inge will be talking Wednesday on WILL at 11 o'clock with Linda Beards, who's professor of English at University of Washington, about poetry. And right before that, on Wednesday, on Focus 580, David will be talking with Karen Landgren, who's head of the Child Protection Service at UNICEF, about children in the crossfire. Karen Landgren is the Daniel S. Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecturer here at the university at the School of Social Work, and will be giving a lecture as well. But you can hear here on the radio Wednesday at 10 o'clock on Focus 580. Those are some of the programs that I think listeners to Keeping the Faith might find of interest. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the university. It has been here 132 years now, continuing to help develop student leaders by providing opportunities for social action and community service. One of the Y programs coming up this week, led by student Ashley Peterson, who is president of Students for Environmental Concerns at the Y, is a fascinating program dealing with environmental issues. Coming up Wednesday, April 20 at 4 o'clock at the Y at 1001 South Wright Street here in Champaign, University Y, will be a film and a panel. And the film is The Hidden Faces of Environmental Justice. It's a free film. Following the film, a U of I student will talk about his experience in the Amazon and dealing with rainforest issues. Professor Ken Salo, S-A-L-O, will talk about human rights and eco-political struggles for social justice in South Africa. And a Quaker activist, Charlotte Green, will talk about her experiences dealing with the issues of nuclear power here in Illinois. So that's coming up this Wednesday, April 20 at 4 o'clock at the University of Y. If you have questions, call the Y at 337-1500. And then another program that Students for Environmental Concerns is putting on as part of this series is the following Thursday, April 21 at 6:30 at Boardman's Art Theater on Church Street in downtown Champaign. The keynote speaker is Sandra Steingraber. She's the author of Living Downstream, and she'll be talking. Her title of her talk is Contaminated Without Consent, The Struggle for Environmental Justice from the United Nations to Iliopolis, Illinois. And there'll also be a showing of Blue Vinyl, the award-winning documentary film on the health consequences of pollution from PVC manufacturing. All these events are free and open to the public. And if you would like to check out a website, you can go to Steingraber, Steingraber.com. And I guess that's enough announcements for today. I'll remind listeners that the University YMCA continues on this campus in its programs, including environmental programs, because of the generosity of people who care about our mission. And one way we accept, of course, gifts of any kind of contributions, but we are coming up to our big dump and run program where students who are moving out in the spring often can't carry home all the things that they've accumulated during the year for their apartment or a dorm room. And the Y will take all those extras. So instead of putting them in a dumpster and adding to the waste stream, do consider in May bringing those any usable items to the University Y, or look for the big collection bins around the campus and community. So starting the week of May 10, bring those things to the Y, and we save them. And in the fall, we have a grand garage sale, the biggest one in this part of Illinois, at the Stock Pavilion at the university. And it's a fundraiser for the Y, and we also help entering students, particularly international students, furnish their apartments with these items. So consider the University Y at 1001 South Wright Street. Well, back to our guest today. Joe Mann has been waiting patiently to talk some more about small churches and the Duke Endowment, and how the Duke Endowment helps small congregations with some very needed money. Many small churches, Joe, I think, feel that if they have money, that's all they need, that they're struggling so hard to survive financially. But that doesn't sound like that's the case. It sounds like it's more a matter of spirit and creativity, although your money obviously helps.
Our money can help, absolutely, if there isn't that spirit of creativity, as you said, then all the money we gave them wouldn't do any good at all. One area that I guess maybe bears that out, we have, as I think you in Illinois, I know as you in Illinois, a fair number of Habitat homes being built and
oh, yes.
and other programs for mm-hmm. low-income housing, mm-hmm. a great need across all our country. We have found that we have small membership churches, some with only 40 or 50 people worshiping on a Sunday, who have people in that congregation who actually know how to saw and hammer, which is something I don't know how to do, and I've helped with a Habitat house some. They actually know how to do some things. They don't have, as you were getting at just a moment ago, the resources that will build a house. That, as you probably know, it varies across the country, but can be $50,000 or so in materials to build a house.
And some houses cost even more, I've heard.
And I'm sure that's the case. As a matter of fact, I think I'm giving a North Carolina number. It's probably more expensive in many other areas, exactly. The bottom line is, if we make a challenge to a small membership church and help match those dollars, then we can free that congregation to be in mission to actually go in and really help build a house. And two or three things good happen when that happens. we get the church involved and involved in their community in ways that they might not have been able to do. They get a much better sense of who they are and their own ability to do something and to succeed. And then, of course, we're all helping in the community to build a house with someone who needs a house. So our dollars there are just that kind of challenge. And without people who are willing to do things, we stand ready almost at any point to make a grant to a legitimate, good program, one that we will help judge and figure out whether they make sense or not. And yet I've got churches who don't have that same spirit, who mm-hmm. never call me, who never mm-hmm. seek out a grant to start a child care program or an elder care program or a housing program or a hunger program.
Now, before people who are listening in the Midwest yep. call me asking for your number, let me remind listeners that your program is very limited. By the Duke Endowment is limited only to the state of North Carolina and, in fact, to Methodist churches only. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. Now, I am glad to say that in North Carolina, we have no apology for what Mr. Duke did, and we almost exclusively fund Rural United Methodist Churches, but we can fund and often do ecumenical efforts.
I see.
As you might appreciate, in a small community, to start a child care program can be daunting. If a Presbyterian church, a Methodist church, a Baptist church join together, then a lot more can be done. And what we will do in that situation, where there's a true partnership where the Methodist church is truly engaged in that work, we will assist the Rural Methodist Church in that partnership. That's been a very successful way that we have helped some small communities provide some programs that they couldn't. In a small town, Bisco in North Carolina, we've helped a Methodist church on their property to build a warehouse to hold food. Hmm. And then the ecumenical ministry in town has quite a large food pantry and food program that, I'm sorry to say, just continues to grow in need. We mm-hmm. seem to have more and more hungry people in America. Certainly in North Carolina, we've been hard hit by textile and furniture layoffs. We have people who have great need for hunger. And so if we can help a rural Methodist church in partnership with other churches provide that ministry, we believe we're doing what Mr. Duke wants us to do, strengthen the Methodist church in their outreach with others.
Let me give the phone numbers for listeners who may want to call in. If you're far away, you may still use the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And we know we do have listeners online who listen to this program live via their computers at will.uiuc.edu. In Champaign-Urbana, listeners may call with a comment or question at 333-9455, 333-WILL, or toll-free 1-800-222-WILL. Talking with Joe Mann from the Duke Endowment. Now, we haven't talked at all about the part of your job, which is adjunct professor at the Duke Divinity School. A Divinity School is a seminary where Methodists and others, Duke is an ecumenical divinity school, so people from many denominations, Protestant and Catholic, do come there, Orthodox. What do you teach?
I teach, you might imagine, a course called the Town and Country Course. Town and Country is, I know Methodists, but I think some others use the same nomenclature, for small membership churches. And so I offer a course that focuses on the dynamics of small membership churches so that students, and I guess my students are almost always across the board in varying degrees, either people who have grown up in big city churches, have had a call to the ministry, have come to Duke to be trained, but have never stepped foot in a small town or certainly not in a small membership church. And so they take this course because they are quite aware, as is true for, I think, almost every denomination, most pastors will serve at least a portion, if not their entire career, in small membership churches. I also have some people who are actually serving in churches as student pastors, a fair number of them each year, and what they're trying to do, I think, is to maybe figure out what they're doing, but also have a place to test out, to talk about what they're experiencing in their church. And it makes for a nice mix of some students who've never been in a real church, some students who are currently serving in those settings as a student pastor. And so we'd really try to talk about what the small town is, the dynamics of a small town, and it can be difficult for someone who hasn't lived in a small town. I guess we don't need to be romantic about either small towns or small churches. They do present problems for many persons moving into them. So we talk about their problems, but we really mostly focus on assets. For a long time now, people have looked at small membership churches and, as you said earlier in our talk, seen them as almost anachronisms. They'll soon fade away, when in fact they don't. They're still there, hale and somewhat hardy, in many cases very hardy. And so what we try to do is to celebrate these churches, see them as places where you can be fully in ministry, where you can be engaged in ministry, enjoy your ministry, be fulfilled in your ministry, and serve a great need. And so I think that's basically try to give a kind of positive sense to what it's like to be in those churches. And it's quite positive. These are places where people connect and love each other, and they can certainly love the pastor. They can also be places that are closed and not open even to their pastor. So there can be challenges and all that as well.
Now, you mentioned earlier in the program, and I'll repeat it for listeners who may have joined us later, that 54% of all Protestant Christians in America are in a congregation on a Sunday that has less than, what did you say, 100 or 75 people?
100 uh-huh. people, yeah.
In that congregation.
Right. And so there are pastors who graduate seminary who, I guess it's fair to say, think about a career, think about where they're going to be 20, 30 years from now. And in many instances, whatever their thoughts are, whether they think they're going to be in Champaign or they think they're going to be in Chicago or wherever they think, they often are not. There are only so many urban churches out there. There are, as we've noted, many smaller numbers of them, where there are greater numbers of these small membership churches. So many pastors have to come to a sense of appreciation for small membership churches, because that's, in fact, where they're going to serve for much of, if not their entire career.
Now, how can a pastor be paid enough to live on in a congregation that only has 75 people yep. there on a Sunday?
It's an enormous challenge. Numbers vary. Some people say you've got to have at least a couple of hundred giving units to really be able to afford a full-time pastor, and those numbers actually keep increasing, not because pastor salaries increase, they probably have been rather stable, but health care costs for pastors as well as everybody else keep rising, retirement costs rise. So it's getting to be expensive, very expensive, for a church with 100 people or less on a Sunday to afford a pastor. So churches and different denominations handle it differently. Increasingly, there are part-time pastors, people who will be a school teacher or a professional in the community, or who will say, I will work part-time in this setting.
And take some special training.
Typically, almost everyone requires at least a modicum of training. It will typically not be a full seminary training, but will be some training, exactly.
And so what about grouping small congregations? Is that still
done?
That's
another model that I know that some Presbyterians and Methodists have used a lot, not as much Baptist, I think, or Lutherans. But, yes, you group your churches into what we call a circuit, or a multi-church parish. And in that setting, one pastor, and sometimes if the parish is large enough, maybe a couple of pastors, will serve two, three, four. And in some places, particularly out west, in some places in the mountains of North Carolina, some of the more remote areas, you might have six, seven, eight churches on one circuit that a pastor will serve. And in that sense, then, obviously, the two, three, four, five churches together will can afford to pay the pastor, provide housing, and provide all the things that go with a full-time pastor. The problem with that is the load that the one pastor has to carry, trying to serve 2 to 6 congregations. These congregations are not all homogeneous. They often are very different in what they present. I've known some pastors to prepare a sermon, and on their ride to the next church where they will be preaching, have to change it because it's such a different congregation. These congregations also don't always share very readily with one another. They really would like to be independent and want to, as a matter of fact, enjoy their independence. So they share the pastor. They will share some programming, but they sometimes do it in a begrudging fashion. So it's a real challenge. I think we see, in some settings, more lay pastors, in some settings, a heavy use of retired pastors. In some other settings, this is, I guess, a kind of part-time, a special minister, a minister, say, who is a campus minister on a college campus who might also go on weekends to serve a church. I think you've hit one of the bigger problems that the small membership church in almost every denomination has to figure out is how we will maintain pastoral leadership in these settings.
Now, does your money from the Duke Endowment that's specified in the state of North Carolina for these small membership Methodist churches, do you ever go to use some of it to supplement a salary for a pastor?
It's a very good question. Almost never.
Why not?
We have felt like all along that basic level of supporting a pastor, if a church or churches can't do that, then our grant money, which is typically short term, we're going to help a church start a program, get it off the ground, and we fully expect that that church, after we've helped them begin it, will be able to maintain that program. If we pay the salary of the pastor, one, our grant dollars would be gone quicker than we want. And two, we don't think we'd be investing in an institution that's really very strong, and so why would we want to invest there? The catch there, though, Steve, that we've made, and we have responded to situations that show great promise. We have, say, a rural church just outside of Charlotte, where great growth is going in terms of housing. People want to be able to afford a house, and many don't want to live right in the city anyway. So they go out to the countryside and buy into a housing development. A little rural church, Methodist church out there, needs to respond to that new growth, this new community of folks. And they need a pastor who has some abilities and skills to help the church do that. So we will sometimes invest in an addition to what that church is able to pay, a challenge. The church is able to pay a base salary, then we might give a little bit larger salary so the church can hire the person that they really need. And in that way, what we'll do is we'll say we will work with you for maybe 3 or 4 years, usually on a declining basis, and expect the church over time to pick up the rest of that salary. So sometimes we do help. It's not very often, and usually it's quite specific, quite targeted, either a church that we think has great possibility just hasn't quite taken hold and hasn't seen that possibility. But no, we do think that every church needs to figure out how they pay the pastor's salary. And if they can't do that, then they probably can't be engaged in some of the other things that we would like to see them engaged in.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Joe Mann, who is the director of the Rural Church Division for the Duke Endowment. Joe, tell us again, how much money per year do you give as in these grants to the rural churches in the Methodist Church in that state because of the gift years ago in 24 from James B. Duke?
It's a remarkable thing what Mr. Duke did. I mean, he established an endowment that we hope will go on for forever. I couldn't say perpetuity. It won't come out, but forever. And we'll make grants, just our division alone, for churches and to the Divinity School. We also have a very unusual, I just said we don't pay preachers' salaries, and we typically don't, but Mr. Duke cared for retired Methodist preachers. He knew that many ministers would enter into ministry and not make very much money, and that's still the case. And so at the end of their career may not have amassed very much wealth to take them into retirement. And so we make what are referred to as superannuate, a beautiful British term for essentially retired Methodist preachers, small grants based on your years of service that do support retired Methodist ministers. So we make grants of this year and actually the last 2 years slightly over $11 million. About the same grants go to our child care division. Our largest divisions are education division and our health care division, and both of them make grants slightly in the $40 million range.
We're down to our last couple minutes of the program today. Tell us again, sort of, how could you encourage someone today to do what James B. Duke did back in 1924, perhaps in another region of the country like Illinois and Indiana?
Well, I would hope that someone who has been blessed with wealth would see that we all stand on shoulders of a whole society of folks who helped us gain that wealth. And in essence, that was what Mr. Duke did. He looked around and said, I've gained enormous wealth, and I want to pay back to the communities and to the area where I came from and who generated much of this wealth. And specifically also, as we said, I want to help fund programs of Methodist churches. It would not take $2.3 billion to make a difference. If a person with some wealth wanted to set up a small foundation, community foundations will help them do that. Often denominations have offices that and foundations within the denomination that can help you do that. Banks can help you do that. There are a variety of ways. And, of course, there are now Fidelity has been probably the largest brokerage that does that, but others do it as well. You can set up a foundation and then earmark it for the things that you care about, the things that you believe are important. And I would urge you to think about congregations and churches. Set it up in such a way that you specify the type of program or the limits of what you want to do. But it can be an enormous asset. We have these churches who I think are assets for communities. They've been there a long time. They've offered services. They're places that people see and know. And if they have just a bit of help, then they can continue in where they are and reach out to community needs like child care, elder care, health care services, feeding programs, to just name a few. I would hope someone, and I know in Illinois there are people who have made a lot of money.
We're going to have to stop with just that comment. We've been talking with Joe Mann, who's the director of Rural Church Division of the Duke Endowment, about small membership churches. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm usual host for this Keeping the Faith programs. If you'd like to hear this program in the future, if you didn't just heard part of it, like to hear more, you can go to our archive online at will.uiuc.edu. Past programs are collected there. Martin Marty was a guest a couple months ago, and we've had other guests of note. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
James Hood had a dream. He wanted to go to college and get an education. But there was a problem. Hood was a black man in segregated Alabama in 1963. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, a variety of views and opinions from black Americans on their expectations of freedom. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. WILL is now accepting your donations of old records, tapes, CDs, DVDs, and working stereo equipment for our annual Vintage Vinyl fundraising sale on May 21st at Lincoln Square Village in Urbana. Bring your records, tapes, CDs, and DVDs to Schnuck Supermarkets in Champaign, Urbana, Bloomington, and Springfield, or call 217-333-1070 for a complete list of drop-off sites. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly clear with a low in the lower 50s and southwest winds around 10 miles per hour this evening, becoming light and variable. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the upper 70s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s and southwest winds around 10 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.